Good evening, Rick. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, you've had a long career with NASA. Perhaps you could outline how you got into NASA in the first place.
It's very interesting. When I was finishing high school and entering university, it was the time that John Kennedy said that we should go to the moon, and that was something I wanted very much to be part of as a student, and I ended up going to Rice University and after graduating in physics from Vanderbilt and doing a PhD in space physics at Rice under Brian O'Brien, who was from Australia, who came to Rice from University of Sydney, and got into to doing research in space, worked at Lockheed, and then went to NASA. So I've always been fascinated with the idea of space exploration, both robotic and human exploration, and my career at NASA enabled me to enjoy both of those things.
Perhaps you could go through some of the programs you worked on while you were at the in the university environment.
Well, at university, we did a sounding rocket program that measured the aurora. Professor O'Brien had done that when he was in Australia in the Antarctic. And then at Lockheed, we began to study the nature of particles that you find in the space environment around the Earth, close to the Earth, above the ionosphere, so above about 1,000 kilometers, up to several hundred thousand kilometers in a region dominated by the Earth's magnetic field. It's called the magnetosphere. And the magnetosphere captures and energizes particles that come both from the Earth and the Sun. And some of those become the radiation belts, and some of those cause the aurora. The energetic electrons hit the top of the atmosphere and cause the aurora. So I worked on that beginning in right after university and continued through my entire career at NASA, and still, in fact, am doing research connected to that from the Polar Satellite, which was launched a few years ago by NASA and which has an instrument that we built at the Marshall Space Flight Center that measures the composition of the gases in space around the Earth. And you can tell by how much is hydrogen and how much is oxygen and how much is nitrogen. You get an indication of whether they come from the Sun or from the Earth.
Was the discovery of the Van Allen belt by Van Allen with the first American satellites, was that a total surprise to scientists, or was it more or less expected?
Well, it was a total surprise because he would, in fact, his instrument was not to measure the radiation belts, it was to measure cosmic rays. So they were Geiger tubes that were put on the satellite, launched above the atmosphere with the idea of measuring the characteristics of cosmic rays that we know come into the Earth from deep space. And as the satellite went around the Earth and began penetrating the radiation belt regions, which we now know are there, the Geiger tubes counted extremely highly. It was something that he wasn't even looking for, and he was able to identify these areas of trapped radiation in the Earth's magnetic field with energies of a million electron volts or so, and they became known as the Van Allen radiation belts.
The actual counters got oversaturated, didn't they? And they had to build later satellites with more, less sensitive instruments.
Exactly. And in fact, Dr. Van Allen, together with my advisor, Brian O'Brien, worked on the follow-on satellites that were built in connection with the University of Iowa that began to give more and more information about the shape and the energy and the distribution of the particles that form the radiation belts.
Do we still have things to learn about the radiation belts?
Well, we do. I think the biggest thing about the radiation belts these days, we can model them fairly well now, but the biggest thing is to understand how much of the radiation belts come from particles that start off in the Earth's ionosphere with energies of less than one electron volt and end up getting energized in the Earth's magnetosphere to energies of more than a million electron volts and become part of the radiation belts, as opposed to the original thought, which was that the radiation belts came entirely from either the Sun, high energy particles from the Sun, or particles that were caused by cosmic rays hitting the top of the atmosphere and generating energetic particles. So the thing that's, I think, remaining on the radiation belts that's very exciting is how much of the radiation comes from the Sun and how much comes from the Earth.
You said you began in sounding rockets. Is there still a role for sounding rockets in magnetospheric research?
There is. They tend to be used, for example, they're launched a lot out of Alaska. A lot of the U.S. rockets are. I hope Australia gets back into the rocket launching business. But they're able to give us higher spatial resolution information about the aurora, which is a very fast-moving and highly striated object. Satellites go over the aurora, you know, at 8 kilometers per second, and so you've got to measure everything pretty quick. Whereas a sounding rocket can go through the aurora at more like a half a kilometer per second and can get a lot better resolution. So there's a nice complementary use of sounding rockets that can be coupled with the satellite measurements.
And you left the university environment and went and joined NASA. Why did you do that?
Well, I think I have always been interested in the broader aspect of space exploration, and in the States, NASA's where the action is there. There are a lot of wonderful people who do satellite research who are based in universities, but I think NASA being the principal agency of space exploration is just the place to be if you're more interested in the broader elements of things. And I went to NASA actually after university. I went to Lockheed Research Lab in Palo Alto, California, did satellite research there, and then I went to NASA because I wanted to get involved in science that could be done from the space shuttle, or that would involve humans in space doing science as opposed to robotic spacecraft.
Was that partly motivated by a personal desire to go up there and do it yourself?
It's interesting. At the time that I went to NASA, I didn't know I had that desire. I think I did not. At that time, most of the astronauts had been pilots, and I had not gone through any flight training or any military experience, and so I didn't see myself as even able to do that. But once I got there and became involved in the space lab missions, we generated a new type of space explorer that is the payload specialist, who is a scientist principally who trains to fly on a specific mission and use his or her scientific expertise to carry out the experiments. And so it opened up a new area of opportunity, and I was the chief scientist for the first flight of the Space Lab, which the European Space Agency built together with NASA. That brought me even closer to human spaceflight because we selected payload specialists for that flight, and after it was over, I became interested in flying on a follow-on mission and was selected by the scientists on that mission to be a backup payload specialist, which I then did and trained for 7 years and got right up to the point of flying and could have flown had one of my colleagues not been able to.
Are you disappointed that you didn't go then?
Well, I think everybody who sets their sights on flying in space wants to get to that point. However, I went about it as a glasses half full rather than half empty approach, and I was able to do this very, very special training over a number of years with a unique set of people in a unique place, and was able to do something that not more than a couple of hundred people in the world have been able to do, that is to go through the training and enjoy that experience. And it was a tremendously special one. So I don't look back on it in a negative way. I look back on it in a very positive way that I got to be part of and very close to the manned spaceflight community.
Most of our listeners will be familiar with Space Lab that goes up inside the shuttle. Astronauts work inside in sleeveless environment, and they'll be familiar perhaps with the biomedical experiments done there, perhaps even with the materials processing. But what can you do for magnetic fields studies and particle studies on Space Lab that you can't do on an unmanned spacecraft?
What we did on the Space Lab 1 mission and the Atlas mission, which is the one that I trained for, was to do what was called active space plasma experiments, in which we perturbed the Earth's plasma and magnetic field environment using instruments on the pallet structure out behind the space lab in the shuttle payload bay. For example, the Japanese built a very large electron accelerator, And instead of measuring the natural aurora, we made our own aurora by firing electron beams off the shuttle down into the Earth's atmosphere below the shuttle, and then used a low light level imaging device that was built by Steve Mendy at Lockheed to image the aurora that we produced. And so it was a way of doing sort of an input-output experiment where you control the input of electrons and then measure the light that's generated when they hit the atmosphere, as a way of doing a controlled auroral experiment. And there are other things like that. You can inject waves, you can inject ionized gases like barium and measure the electric field distributions. You can cause instabilities to be generated through the waves that you inject, and a lot of different things can be done from the shuttle.
The early drawings of Space Lab and the shuttle showed it flying with a huge antenna, whip antenna at each side, the Waves in Space experiment. That was never flown. Why?
That was never flown. I think NASA began aggressively with the shuttle program to do active experiments on space plasmas, and the Waves in Space plasmas, the WISP experiment, was one of those. I think there came to be, as budgets tightened, less of a commitment to the active plasma experiments and more of a commitment to the robotic spacecraft, given maybe not an adequate budget to do both. And the community, the science community that does space physics, is largely associated with automated spacecraft, robotic spacecraft. And so their interest in the way NASA should proceed with its experimentation was certainly weighted toward automated spacecraft. And in the end, I think that caused the Waves in Space plasma experiment not to be completed. I'm sorry it wasn't. I think it would have been a great experiment.
And of course, an Australian scientist was very much involved in that program.
Absolutely, and it was I was associated with it from the beginning of in going to NASA. Originally, I was a project scientist for a future mission that looked into all the ways we might use the shuttle to do space plasma physics, and one of those was the wave injection experiment, which initially came out of, I think, TRW in California, and then it grew and had a lot of great involvement internationally, and would have been the WISP experiment ultimately to find the shuttle. And again, I'm sorry it didn't. It should have.
What practical application does an understanding of our magnetic environment and the radiation belts around the Earth have?
Well, the main thing for space plasma physics has to do with understanding the way the Earth's magnetosphere responds to changes in the sun, and those typically manifest themselves in things like the changing aurora, a change of characteristics of the ionosphere, which affect communications at low altitude, that is, things that radio, for example, that bounces off the ionosphere, or radar, over-the-horizon radar systems, things like that. So being able to understand and model in advance changes in the ionosphere that are going to change communication is an important element. Farther out, the magnetospheric particles can affect satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit, and in fact still, even though we do lots of things to try to prevent it, large convulsive changes in the solar wind as it flows out of the sun can affect the magnetosphere's size and particle energy such that it can cause charging of satellites that are found at geosynchronous orbit, like communication satellites. And if the satellite is not designed correctly, it can have discharges from one part of the satellite to the other, which can harm the electronics in the satellite, in some cases take it offline, or in some cases command it to do something that you didn't want it to do, like begin to spin or things like that. So there are a number of things related to communications, surges in the aurora, surges in magnetic currents, or magnetic and electric currents in the top of the ionosphere also can affect power grids, but they induce current surges in power grids in the higher latitude countries like Canada, for example, and can take the power grid down every once in a while during big solar storms. So there are a number of things related to communications and electrical systems that are vulnerable to magnetospheric storms.
The first Ariane 5 launch ended in a rather spectacular fireworks. The payload, of course, was a cluster which is devoted to magnetospheric studies. And now a replacement one is being built to be launched on Russian Soyuz vehicles. Did NASA have any involvement in cluster?
NASA did. There were several instruments that NASA contributed substantially to, and then there were several investigations that had NASA-sponsored scientists from America involved. And the cluster is a great mission, and I'm happy that we're doing the follow-on. The instrument that we have on the Polar satellite, which is still operating, will be aided a great deal by the measurements that will be made on cluster once it gets launched.
You eventually left NASA. Why?
In my last years at NASA, I spent a lot of time as the chief scientist for the Marshall Space Flight Center, talking to the public about why we should do space exploration. And it became very clear to me in doing that the critical role that the media plays in communicating not only space exploration to the public, but science in general and technology in general to the public. They are almost a single point failure in terms of the communication linkage between the scientists who do research through the media then to the public. The public almost entirely gets what it knows about science and technology from the media. And yet, unfortunately, not many of the people in the media have training and interest in science and technology. And so it's not reported with the accuracy and, in my mind, with the degree of emphasis that it should be. Your show aside, by the way, because it's great that you're doing what you're doing. And so my goal in my last year and a half at NASA was to look into the challenges of communicating science to the public, and I did a fellowship at Vanderbilt that NASA covered my salary and encouraged me to do it, but it was sort of a joint fellowship venture with Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, and Jim Hartz and I did a study about that and came up with a number of recommendations that we felt could cause changes that would make this better. And so I decided at the end of the fellowship to retire from NASA and to join the faculty at Vanderbilt and to put a program in place which trains communicators of science and technology, and we've done that now. And starting this coming fall, students in undergraduate school will be able to get an interdisciplinary major in the communication of science, engineering, and technology. And there'll be kids who liked everything they took in high school, made A's in everything, liked English as well as physics, French as well as higher math, and we'll be able to train them to be comfortable in understanding of science and engineering and able to communicate it to the public that largely doesn't understand it. So I was very strongly motivated to do that, and we'll see how it goes. I have high hopes.
And what brings you to Australia?
The meeting, the Science Now meeting, which I think, by the way, is a wonderful thing that the Australian science communicators are doing, has an opportunity to talk about some of the key aspects of communicating science to the public. And I was invited by the committee to come and be part of a panel session that will take place on this coming Sunday about science and the media and the things that we can do to enhance the communication of science and engineering to the public.
Well, thank you for joining us tonight on The Space Show, Rick.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.